You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Okay, happy Thanksgiving. Little children still in Asia. And we're going to continue on with the review of quiz four, everything but the last question. So let's start with our motivation. And recently I received a letter from somebody who is having lots of chronic health problems and daily interference with their life due to this. But they were saying that the thing that was the hardest for them actually was their kind of spiritual confusion. They unfortunately don't have really a religious tradition that they can rely on. So I was thinking how fortunate we are and just how we need to consider the causes of this, and those are outlined in these teachings by Nagarjuna. And so for our motivation tonight, what I'd like people to do is because the teachings tonight are on emptiness and those are so challenging, and also developing single point of concentration, and some of these things are just, you know, they seem a ways off. I wanted people just to take a moment to think of something that's within, you feel is within your capacity to actually accomplish in this path. And then think about making a commitment to work on that. And then each day, dedicate your merit for the accomplishment of this stepping stone with the wish to have it be one of the causes for your full awakening. So let's put our sights on the longest term goal and keep in mind the steps along the way. So we're on quiz four, and we're going to do questions 15 through 18 tonight, which will leave one question on that for next week, but it changes chapters. We're at the end of chapter one, actually, in this quiz. So the first question is 15. What does not seeing is the best seeing mean? Does anyone want to chime in? Yeah.
Referring to directly non-conceptually seeing that's done only by ayahs in meditative equipoise and emptiness.
Right. So this best not seeing is the best seeing. The best seeing is this direct non-conceptual realization that Aryas have when they're in meditative equipoise on emptiness. That's the best seeing. And how about the not seeing?
Not seeing, well, seeing non-dual awareness.
Seeing with a non-dual awareness.
Inherent existence.
Not seeing inherent existence.
Seeing truths. Not seeing the
not seeing what?
Veiled truth,
not seeing the veiled
truth.
Truth.
Not seeing the difference between subject and object.
Yeah, not seeing the difference between subject and object. Right. So in the when I answered each of these questions, I did it kind of in brief, and then kind of tried to look at the text and understand what was happening in the text with the commentary. So, yes, this is the main. These are the main points that this not seeing. What are we not seeing? We're not seeing inherent existence. And who is it that doesn't see that? It's an Arya, while they're in meditative equipoise. So, of course, it'd be a Buddha too. But this verse is actually referring to Aryas. And so there's some misunderstanding sometimes where people think that this refers to blank-minded meditation. And so that's a mistaken idea. So emptiness is... Yeah, when you think about blank-minded meditation, your mind is on nothing, and you could think that that was an empty state of, you know, that you could think you'd realized emptiness, but emptiness isn't something that's understood through realizing just the mere non-existence of an object. You actually you're not realizing a non-existent object. You're realizing an existent object. Emptiness exists. And what are you realizing? You're realizing an absence of the inherent existence or objective existence. So Geshe Tekchuk, in another text, I'm using mostly his references tonight, but I'm using both the text that will be coming out soon on Precious Garland, but also his insight into emptiness. And he talks about this scriptural passage in there too, not seeing as the perfect seeing is how he worded it. And he voiced this in the terms of, when we search for the object of negation, we won't find it. So, and then he references that back to not seeing of inherent existence is the perfect seeing. So not seeing the object of negation, not seeing the object of negation, meaning not seeing inherent existence, we'll see the perfect phenomena, emptiness. So he used the word perfect for that. Is that making sense to people?
Say that again. So the not seeing?
Yes, so not seeing, the way he worded it, he brought in the idea of what you're not seeing is the object of negation, mm-hmm. which is inherent existence. And then the verse was just worded a little bit different. Other than that, it's the same. So which verse did you think went along with this question? So I'm now going to the text, and we're going to just... I've picked out verse 93. So it actually comes up a few times tonight the verses that we'll be talking about will be 93 through 99. And this ends up coming up a few times. But when Venerable's talked about it, it's mostly with this verse, I believe. So that verse reads, "The sage has stated that earth, water, fire, and wind, short and long, thick and thin, virtue and so on, cease in the awareness of the ultimate." And that's the ceasing part. That's the not seeing. And so what does that really mean? What is the meaning of phenomena being empty of inherent existence? Let's start with that. So what Geshe Tekchuk talks about is that phenomena could be the subject of a syllogism that proves non-inherent existence. And he said, and this is something that we covered, earth is not inherently existent. That's the subject of a syllogism, a statement of, you know, a kind of reasoning where you're going to prove the lack of inherent existence. So the subject is, earth is not inherently existent. And it goes on, because if it were, it would have to be seen by the Arya's wisdom of meditative equipoise. The reason is indicated because the sage, the Buddha, stated that the elements cease in the awareness of the ultimate. So here, the reason they're using to prove this is what I would consider scriptural authority in the way this is worded. So this is how it starts. And what it's really meaning is that these things, like earth, water, fire, wind, short, long, thin, thick, virtue, all these things are not seen by this Arya's meditative equipoise on emptiness. They've ceased. And that ceasing doesn't mean that they're non-existent. It means they don't appear. So that's where, when you read these verses sometimes without the explanation, you could easily come to some different conclusions and think, let's just meditate on nothing, have a blank mind, right? But it's the ceasing is that they cease in the meaning that they don't appear. That's what that refers to. And this is non-dualistic, which we'll spell out more fully, but just some things that are not, that the meaning of that being non-dualistic is there's no appearance of subject and object. So in this mind, only emptiness is appearing. Conventional objects aren't appearing to it, and there's no appearance of inherent existence. So they describe this mind as the mind that is mixed with this object of emptiness is like fresh water mixed with fresh water. This is where you hear that saying. So this is a mind that, a kind of wisdom actually, that's knowing the ultimate nature of all phenomena. That's what we're talking about. We're perceiving phenomena as they really are. So if the earth and so forth and all these things that they talked about, if those existed inherently, then this wisdom that sees the ultimate nature should see inherent existence, if they existed that way. But that isn't what happens. For these aryas, these both the conventional objects and inherent existence of them don't appear. And why is that? Well, we come up to that. But mainly what we're trying to understand in this first verse is that not seeing is the best seeing. And basically, they aren't seeing conventional objects. Well, they aren't seeing conventionalities. That's a better way to say it. And they're not seeing inherent existence. But this doesn't mean, you know, in general, if things exist, they don't have to be seen by this Arya's meditative wisdom. That's the thing that gets confusing. That's why you could think things just don't exist at all, because, hey, they don't see it. But the reason they don't see them is because they don't see conventionalities. It only perceives the ultimate nature, this kind of mind. And again, if their ultimate mode of existence, we're saying the same thing with different words now. If the ultimate mode of existence was that things were inherently existent, then that wisdom should perceive that. But it perceives the opposite. It perceives the emptiness of inherent existence. And then we go into the next couple verses, still in the same question, verse 94 and 95. Earth, water, fire, and wind cannot find any place to exist in that indemonstrable, limitless, full sovereign awareness, short and long, subtle and coarse, virtue and non-virtue, and also name and form, all cease in this awareness. So from this perspective, this, of this ultimate wisdom, none of these things can find any place to exist. That's what that verse says, cannot find any place to exist. So there's no footing for them to stand on, because the footing would have to be some inherent existence or true existence. And that doesn't appear to this mind. Those objects only appear to our ordinary consciousnesses, because that's what we see. We see things as inherently existent. And then, and I got lost. I listened to Venerable's teaching. I want to see whatever I missed. So why doesn't this wisdom see conventionalities, she says? Because they're fake. I thought that was pretty good. They appear truly existent, but they aren't. So another thing she said that was interesting, and I questioned her about this, I find this still a little hard to grok, but that's because we can't understand what a non-dual mind is. She said this thing about water poured into water is the mind realizing its own nature. And so when I asked her about this, because I was like, I feel like I'm missing a step here, you know, like, how do we get from A to C? And she said, the mind that's perceiving the emptiness of all phenomena, that's what's happening at that point, is perceiving the emptiness of all phenomena. And it's very powerful because it's now seeing the true nature of its own mind. So it's just completely, like, merged. We just can't, the reason I think I couldn't grok it is because we can't really figure out what would it be to be lacking subject and object, and, you know, like, the different characteristics of a non-dual awareness were, like, beyond our, you know, beyond.
So the sense was the mind that is perceiving emptiness of all phenomena is...
Is perceiving the emptiness of all phenomena. When Arya is in meditative equipoise on emptiness, it's like water poured into water. The mind's realizing its own nature, which is emptiness.
Okay.
And why? That's why I asked her, why? How do you get to that point? It's because that wisdom is realizing that perceiving the emptiness of all phenomena at that point. That always really... I still feel like there's a few steps missing, but I think that if you were there and you could imagine what it would be to have a non-dual mind, it would make more sense. You know what I mean? You wouldn't have subject and object, you know? It always, where I fall apart, I guess I don't need to confuse you, so we won't. We could talk about that later. But anyway, that's what she said. And then she also said, something else that that she talked about regarding verses 94 and 95 was, the best kind is seeing compared to what? And she said, you're comparing this Arya's meditative equipoise on emptiness to an ordinary consciousness that has an inferential realization of emptiness. And in that mind, that's not a non-dual awareness. So it's got true existence is still appearing because there's the conceptual appearance, which is a conventional phenomenon. So that's when they talk about best mind compared to what in verses 94 and 95, that's what that refers to. Here's my cheat sheet. Just reviewing. Okay, so. I'll make sure I didn't miss anything. So in that sense, this not seeing of the Aryas is superior to the inferential realization of emptiness, which are of still ordinary beings. So what is it that makes this meditative equipoise, now we're going to kind of consolidate this thing about being non-dual, and why it impacts the mind so much for a non-dual realization. It's the one that, the inferential one, is still very impactful, but it's still conceptual. It still has dualistic appearance of subject and object, true existence, conventional phenomena, are all still appearing to that mind. So, in contrast, in Arya, when they're realizing emptiness, there's no dualistic appearance. So there's no, it's free of any conventional appearances. It's free of the appearance of subject and object. It's free of conceptual appearances, the being generality. It's free of the appearance of true existence. So they are seeing reality just as it is. And so that, for these are the reasons why it's superior. That's why it's the best seeing. Is that clear?
Yeah, but don't you wonder if you have decent concentration,
mm-hmm.
and you're having an inferential realization of emptiness. So what's appearing as truly existence is truly existent is emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you're seeing cars and trucks and cups either.
It's completely, from what Jeffrey's taught us, very impactful.
Right. So it's just a funny thing to try to imagine so that's hard enough to imagine, this inferential realization. And then even that is a conceptual appearance. But how do you know it's a conceptual appearance?
Right.
And how do you know when it becomes not? Don't you wonder that? I wonder that.
Well, actually, one way you'll know... no, I take that back.
I know, just go find out.
But you are realizing emptiness.
Yeah.
You know, the apprehended object is emptiness. It's the appearing object that's the conceptual appearance. So I don't think you can make that apple go back up with that one. Ask Jeffrey that. That's a good question. How would the person know? I like that question. Okay, let's go to our next question, which is 16. It has kind of two parts. Does realizing emptiness destroy conventionalities? And why don't conventional truths appear to an Arya's wisdom realizing emptiness? Anybody want to take a stab? Or do you want me to give you the in brief?
First of all,
yes.
No.
Yeah, I know. There's a very short answer. You can answer some of these very short.
Yes, some of these are short.
Just does realizing emptiness destroy conventionalities? No. That's the shortest answer.
I've got something from England.
Yeah.
It's quite long.
That's okay.
Why don't you just read the first paragraph, but it kind of captures it too. So
hold
he
on.
Says this is what?
Here, just speak closer to that so I don't have to try to repeat it.
Okay.
Not
so
too
this
fast
is
though, because we want to think.
Emptiness. Wisdom destroys all reification and penetrates ultimate truth, while leaving intact the conventional truths that allow us to exist, to make ethical distinctions, and to help those who suffer. Persons and other things exist only in a conventional sense, but existing in just this way is fully sufficient and in fact necessary for them to function as they do. Without any fixed, unchanging intrinsic nature, without any intrinsic capacity to exist, we are nonetheless fully capable of choosing and acting.
Hmm. I picked out some things from his book, too, from that same book. That's, hold on, see back. So another good source for some of these questions was Guy Newland's book, Introduction to Emptiness. And actually, in the back of that book, he has some really nice summary points, by the way, which I hadn't seen before. Okay, so first we'll give the in brief answer. Yeah, please.
I
have my numbering off. What?
So this is actually 17, this question, and you started with 16.
Oh, so I have the numbers off? Did I skip a question altogether?
Yeah, why don't permanent and non-existent inherently is number 15.
Okay, so I guess I started with 16.
Yeah.
Okay, why don't permanent phenomena exist inherently? Okay, let's answer the question.
Nothing exists
inherently.
Are we skipping back to 15?
Yeah, let's do, since we missed it. I think I... When I do these quizzes, the numbers keep shifting and I have to...
They flip around.
Yeah, they flip around, so...
Yeah.
I lost that one, sorry. So, permanent phenomena... the question again is, why don't permanent phenomena exist inherently?
Nothing,
yeah. We're going to actually come up to this later on, too. Nothing exists inherently, yeah.
Permanent phenomena like space has parts.
Right, space has parts.
So, you know, directions. And so
directions.
It's
so it's dependent. Yeah, we're actually going to come into this big time in the very last question, so we'll pick it up again there. It's going to... Yeah, sorry, missed one. It can't exist that way because it wouldn't work. Yeah, I think we'll wait on that because that comes up more clearly when we talk about space. Okay, so we'll go back to where I am, which was 16. Oh, do I have my numbers wrong? What are you saying that is? That's 17. Okay, we're on 17. I'll just renumber as I go. Okay, you just can remind me when I'm off because that's not the kind of thing I track so well. Okay, so... This in verse 96 in the commentary, they talk about how the Aryas, meditative wisdom of meditative equipoise, let's say it that way, it doesn't see conventional phenomena, but that doesn't make them non-existent. Just these conventionalities, they aren't in the purview of that wisdom realized in the ultimate nature. It's similar to how when we're looking at something, we don't see a sound, but that doesn't make the sound non-existent, right? So sound isn't in the scope of a visual consciousness. It's like that. The fact that we can't see sound doesn't make sound non-existent, so it's like that. So in the verse it says, 96 says, all which previously appeared to awareness due to not knowing that reality later will likewise cease in awareness, because one has come to know that reality. I find the verse is a little bit hard. So, when Kinzer Jampa Tekto have talked about this. He said sometimes you'll see these scriptural passages that say, meditate on total non-existence. I'm talking again here about this part of the verse where it says cease and awareness, I think. So we don't really want to understand these passages to mean that we're meditating on nothing, that nothing at all exists. Emptiness never means the total non-existence of conventional things. Because for emptiness to exist, there have to be an object that's empty, right? You can't have emptiness of an I without an I. So, when there is a scriptural passage that says meditate on total non-existence, what that is referring to is the total non-existence of the object of negation of true existence or inherent existence. So really you could take the meaning to be meditate on the total emptiness of true existence, is what he said. So for me, I find before I went really into the text, I went into other sources because I like to just kind of answer the question before I try to figure out what the text is saying. So when they teach emptiness in the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, which is the Prasangika view, it doesn't mean that all phenomena don't exist in and of themselves. But how do they exist then is kind of the question. And so this was, we know, and this kind of goes back to the question that I missed, phenomena depend on other factors. Impermanent phenomena depend on causes and conditions, parts, and being the mind that conceives and labels them. And then the permanent phenomena, they don't have that first one. Permanent phenomena do not depend on causes and conditions. But they do depend on parts and the mind that merely labels them with term and concept. So Guy talked about how everything, when you interrogate it as to the ultimate conditions of its nature, like what it's, everything is found to be empty. There's nothing that can bear an ultimate analysis. But this analysis isn't refuting things. So now we're saying the same thing with different language, right? Things aren't being destroyed. Things aren't becoming non-existence. We're just using a different language now, which helps us, actually. So this analysis isn't refuting things. Not finding things with ultimate analysis just means that they lack any ultimate or essential nature that would be found with that kind of analysis. And also that things exist only conventionally means that they do exist, right? So we're not like, the question asks, is are you destroying conventionalities? No, you're not. And destroying means to make non-existent. So when you think about this, wait to the end for that. One other subtopic is this topic of self-emptiness, which I don't know much about, but basically, let's just go this way. You can't say that this gong is empty of being a gong, because then it would have to be non-existent. It's empty of being inherently existent. So we have to make this distinction. If you say this gong is empty of being a gong, then it actually is non-existent. And that's what some people believe, which the school we're in would completely disagree with that. So we're not destroying things, is the big point. But then the second question, why don't conventional truths appear? Well, you know, we talked about this already a little bit. We don't see sounds no matter how carefully we look. Objects exist conventionally, even though we don't see them with this ultimate analysis. So we're just kind of using different words for something. Guy talks about it like two different radio channels, right? Conventional and ultimate knowledge are distinct, but they're also valid ways of getting useful information about the world. So that's really, I like the way he's talked about that before, these two radio channels. He calls them all things considered, which is like conventional, and always empty all the time, which is another one. So anyone who knows him gets a chuckle out of that one. And we need both of these as you were talking about, we need to have this ultimate knowledge so that we can understand emptiness and get out of cyclical existence, but we also need conventional knowledge. That helps us discern, as you were saying, what's wholesome and unwholesome, and you know, allows us to have compassion for people who exist conventionally, you know. So we need both. But then in the text, now we'll go back to some of the details here, it's a little shorter, luckily. Someone has this qualm, do all conventional objects cease in the perspective of that Arya's meditative equipoise on emptiness? Because, well, yes, they do, but he says, because the wisdom destroys the conventionalities. And that's kind of, you're having the idea that the wisdom is destroying something that existed before. Like inherent existence was there and then the wisdom destroyed it. That's not the case at all. If that was the case, that things were inherently existent, if conventionalities were inherently existent, then they would exist as they appear. And this appearance would be their ultimate nature. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Most people are nodding. Some people are just, what do those words mean? Do you get that point? That's kind of an important point, I think, to understand what's happening with this. If things were inherently existent, you know, if this was inherently existent, it would exist as it appears, right? This, and that means it would be its ultimate nature, because this is what it means. This ultimate analysis is finding the ultimate nature. But that's what the channel B does. You know, the Arya's meditative work, equipoise on emptiness, it perceives the ultimate nature. So if that was the case, that this were inherently existent, that's what it should see. But it doesn't. But if it were the case that this was inherently existent, and then the Arya's meditative equipoise on the ultimate didn't see this, then it would have had to have destroyed it, because it was inherently existent, and then it didn't see it. But that's not the case. These conventionalities just appear, their appearance is false. So the Arya's meditative equipoise on emptiness isn't destroying something that existed previously. Is that making sense?
When it says it would destroy them, what does like,
yeah,
destroy.
Destroy means make non-existent. Right. And so when Venable talked about this, something she said that I thought were kind of nice was, she said, the status of phenomena doesn't change with the realization of emptiness. That's important. We, at the Sakya Monastery, people always asked, what would the world look like to a Buddha? Well, let's just go back. What would the world look like to an Arya? You know?
Same.
Well, it actually looks the same when they're not in meditative equipoise on emptiness. But they know, when they're at a certain level, you know, they know that this is like an illusion. So the point here is that the status of phenomena don't change when you realize emptiness. It's kind of like you're taking off sunglasses. When you take off sunglasses, you haven't changed what you see out there. You've just taken off your sunglasses, right? So in this commentary somewhere, they talk about primordial, emptiness being like primordial. And what does that kind of mean? Well, Venerable talked about no one created inherent existence. So it just doesn't exist at all. And also no one created emptiness. It's just the way things are. In that sense, it's primordial. Okay. So we'll go on to 18.
Can I bring up a doubt?
Yeah, a doubt. Yeah, please.
If we're talking about Buddhas, how they see things.
I don't talk about that.
You just mentioned it. Just
yeah, I try to avoid that subject.
I just had a doubt in my mind that, for sure, they see ultimate truth and they see relative truth, but the way they see relative truth must be different.
Yeah, I think it is.
Because they're realizing that the thing is a dependent arising. And
right.
So
there's things, seeing the two truths simultaneously, so yes. That's different than anybody else. They don't have a channel A and a channel B that are separate.
No.
Their channel A and channel B are like always there.
Water.
So
the standing out to me was that if you actually, when you looked at a conventional object and you understood that it was merely imputed, I think it would appear different. I don't have a source of that. But I just, in my own thinking, it's like you would understand something very different about that.
And what would it look like?
Yeah.
This is the question people always talked about. Go ahead, please.
When I think about that, I don't think that the thing would look different. I think that I would not be in the mix as I am now.
That would be true for an Arya, for sure. But the thing about these Buddhas is some of these things that Aryas are seeing when they're having illusion-like appearance, Buddhas aren't seeing at all. Because they're, you know, that list of these things that we just went through, they don't have all of those. They have some, but not all. We went through this with Jeffrey. They don't see inherent existence. They do see conventionalities somehow. They might take a circuitous route, according to some people, by seeing other people's minds or something. You know what I mean?
Who are you talking about?
Buddhas. Yeah, so they, like everyone else sees things as inherently existent. This is the thing that I just realized a few weeks ago. I just kind of like, really? There's no one, not talking about Buddhas, everyone else, every other sentient being always never sees things correctly, ever. Unless you're in meditative equipoise and emptiness, and then you're not seeing this anyway. But everyone else, all the time, except Buddhas, never sees things, ever. Because the highest level bodhisattvas, like what Jeffrey was going through this week, things are like illusion-like. They're still seeing inherently existent, but the magician, not fooled whatsoever. Not fooled whatsoever. That just kind of blows my mind that we ever figured this out.
What about the 10th ground bodhisattva, the last moment of their meditative equipoise?
Well, he didn't rule that out. So I don't think so, because I don't think they see the two tooths simultaneously yet. But I bet they're pretty darn close.
They're pretty darn close.
If you would ask one what it looks like, we'd like to know.
But then we have things like we hear, and of course this is Tantra, so maybe that's different. But yeah. We have like in the Manjushri Sadhana, Manjushri, I make obeisance to your mind, wherein is illuminated the entire tapestry of the myriad objects of knowledge. Part of it. Mm-hmm. It is a tranquil ocean of unfathomable profundity, of immeasurable breadth, boundless light space itself. So, in talking about the Manjushri's mind's capacity to apprehend all phenomena at the same time without losing its meditative concentration on emptiness, it's right there. It is illuminating the entire tapestry of the myriad objects of knowledge. Right. So, those things appear somehow.
Somehow. Yep, they definitely appear somehow.
Somehow.
Okay, let's move on because we don't really know the answer.
But
we won't say it's inexpressible. Okay, let's go to 18. Does realizing emptiness make things that were once inherently existent now empty of inherent existence? So this kind of was really went back to this verse. The shortest answer is no.
No, and see above.
And see above. But there's more said. So in brief, I think we've answered that. And if it did, that would be a nihilistic view, right? So later in the text, there's this summary that I found helpful when thinking about this. Nothing is totally independent of causes and conditions or any other factors that can be found under analysis. Nothing is totally independent of causes and conditions or other factors that can be found under analysis. Everything relies on something else that is not it. So how could things ever be inherently existent? It's not possible. That to me is like, I don't know, that works. Sometimes these things work and sometimes they don't. And why is this? Nothing exists inherently. It doesn't mean they don't exist at all. They exist, but they don't exist independently. They exist by being designated by conceptuality, merely designated. And still, these things perform their function in this interdependent world. So to me, that helps me a lot because I need that. It's a better proof than the Buddha said, the scriptural authority one. Yeah. I like to have ones that like go back to like, wow, how could it? How could something be inherently existent and function? Impossible.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I don't understand how, if this were true, it would be nihilistic.
Let's see. The Arya's meditative equipoise sees the absence of something that never existed. Therefore, it's not nihilistic. It would be nihilistic if it was negating existence.
Yeah.
You'd be remember the thing here? If this inherently existed and the Arya's meditative equipoise on emptiness didn't see it, it would destroy it. That would be nihilism. It'd be non-existent. That's nihilism. Does that make sense?
Maybe I didn't hear it right. What I heard was, does realizing emptiness make things that this question, that were once inherently existent, now empty of inherent existence, that would be nihilism? Did I hear it wrong?
Yeah, you heard that wrong.
Okay.
But that would be nihilism. Does realizing emptiness make things that were once inherently existent now empty of inherent existence? No. And if it did, yeah, I think that would. Well, I don't know. It's not exactly answered that way.
Yeah.
But
okay.
It wouldn't work.
Okay.
I think it would have to. But so then this point comes up when this is explained, which I thought was kind of nice. This is now kind of, I found this helpful because it restated what we've already learned and it added points and examples. And I think this stuff isn't that easy. So when Geshe Tektrak explained this in Insight to Emptiness, he talked about this verse from Ornament for Clear Realization by Maitreya. And it says, nothing whatsoever is to be removed. Not the slightest thing is to be added. Flawlessly view the flawless. Seeing the flawless will liberate completely. And what was so great to me about this is there's a sadhana that I do weekly, Chinrezig sadhana, where Jamin Khontro inserted that verse with some verses before and after that I just want to read because I always find this so beautiful. One time I had Venerable explain it to me because I was like, what are they saying here? It's so beautiful. I don't know what they're talking about. Anyway, but we're going to go into that verse a little bit. But here it's embedded. And it says, first they draw from, what they do here is he put together a short line from Hevajra Tantra and then this verse worded slightly differently. And then a verse from an Indian master that you can't find on the web who wrote this beautiful thing. So it says, there's no meditation nor any meditator, no deity nor any mantra. Here there is nothing at all to be removed nor anything to be established. Look perfectly at perfection itself. Seeing perfection, you will be free. That's the verse we just did. Since whatever arises is the natural condition, if you pay attention and leave what appears alone, it will appear as pure emptiness. Without question, this is the king of yogas. So what we're talking about here is nothing to remove, also nothing to add. So that's what this question is about. Are you removing something? So Geshe Tepchuk has this part in the book where he talks about nothing to remove and nothing to add. And he explains that when we're meditating on emptiness, we don't realize the non-existence of something that previously existed. Rather, we're realizing the non-existence of something that has never existed. True existence has never existed. Inherent existence has never existed. So that meditation on emptiness isn't destroying true existence because things have never existed that way. There's nothing that you're removing from objects. So it also doesn't add anything new. Like emptiness, you're not adding emptiness to an object either. Like it wasn't empty before and now you meditated on it, you made it empty. That's not it either. We realize something when we realize emptiness that has never existed, which is this true existence. It doesn't exist at all. That's it. So the problem that we had is that because we have this grasping, like we always have these sunglasses on, we thought things existed this way and we were wrong. We took off the sunglasses and say, hey, things aren't all that dark. So then he gives these examples. And the first one was like the scarecrow. When you look in a field and you think there's a person there, it's actually a scarecrow, that's an erroneous mind, right? It's a wrong conception, but you can overcome that with a valid mind. So when we get closer and we see that the scarecrow isn't a person, it's not that we're removing a person and putting a scarecrow there. That's, you know, I like these examples that are easy. So there was never a person there to remove. right? True existence was never there. So we're not removing something, and we're not adding a scarecrow there. We're not adding something new. And then he gives another example, like our body. Our body is impermanent, but we go around like it's permanent. We think it's permanent, but it's always been impermanent. So when you finally get it, that the body is impermanent, it's not like you made the body impermanent and it was permanent before. It was never permanent, right? So you're not adding a quality of impermanence to the body, just like you're not adding emptiness. So as he says, then when we meditate on emptiness, we're not removing true existence. We're not replacing it with emptiness. So we're not adding anything. We're not removing anything. What's being added, he says, what is being removed and added is in relation to our mind. That, again, takes it back from that other thing, you know, about the objects, what's changing. So we're eliminating the ignorance that grafts inherent existence. We're enhancing the wisdom in our mind, and we're transforming that wisdom into a wisdom that realizes reality. But then in the text, now we go to the detail. Someone has this qualm. Does wisdom make things which were previously not empty of inherent existence empty? And this is where they answer, emptiness existed primordially. And we already explained that. So I think we've... And then the last example they give is the one of someone whose sight is obscured by vitreous floaters. Makes you see falling hairs. Sometimes it actually looks like jelly. I'm more experienced with this than last time. you can't always see clearly when they're really a certain kite. Like you're looking at this thing and they float by and it looks like a piece of Vaseline just floated over your eye, you know? So the object itself is quite clear, right? But we don't see it that way because of, you know, when you have this eye disease. But when you cure that disease, when these floaters go away, then you see your eyes, when they're free of defect, you see that this was, you know, it was there as it was clearly all along. So in the same way, our minds are covered with these afflictive obscurations. They can't see the emptiness of inherent existence. They can't see clearly what has always been there, which is the ultimate nature of things. But then if we practice the path, we remove these obscurations. And then I wondered about this one word. Venerable used the word purify their wisdom. Purify your wisdom. I think of it as cultivating wisdom. But in the text I had, the commentary, they use the phrase purify your wisdom. Okay, I would say cultivate. Then you're going to see things as they truly are. Okay, so then we go to verse 97, which kind of, I think, kind of ties together somewhat these overlapping themes that we've had so far. And that verse says... it is maintained that all beings and their qualities are fuel for the fire of awareness. Having been incinerated by brilliant true analysis, they are all pacified. So when fire burns fuel, the fuel ceases to exist. In the same way, when the Arya's meditative equipoise sees emptiness, all the conventional phenomena that appear inherently existent cease. But that doesn't mean they quit existing. They just, in the sense that they don't appear to that wisdom. So we're kind of restating things. But here they have this nice analogy, metaphor maybe. Just as the sun's light eliminates the darkness, Arya's wisdom of meditative equipoise, directly seeing reality, pacifies all elaborations of dualistic appearance. The wisdom sees the ultimate mode of existence of those conventional phenomena in the manner of not seeing the objects themselves. But when they come out, these conventionalities reappear. And they are ascertained by conventional reliable cognizers. Okay, that was that one. So now we're going on to 19. It's a very quick answer. Emptiness is the ultimate truth. Does it exist inherently?
Yeah.
No. Okay, I'm going to, because
this is
we're...
Number 18.
19. So I'm going to just kind of keep going because I don't want to run out of time and keep us overboard, if that's okay. Because I want to get into this thing about space. I went into some side shoots here that Venerable, she talked about some of them, but some she didn't. And I find it helpful because this is the question I had the hardest time with. So I, of course, then went away from the text and went to insight to emptiness. So for prasangikas, so the question is, does emptiness exist inherently? That's basically the question here. It's the ultimate truth. Does it exist inherently? So what does to exist mean for a prasangika? It means to exist conventionally, to exist nominally, to exist as a mere imputation. This is the only kind of existence that they assert. So something that exists isn't going to be findable under ultimate analysis, because if it were findable, it wouldn't exist from its, it would have to exist from its own side, exist ultimately, exist truly, and exist inherently. Now, that is worded a little bit funny. It's not like emptiness doesn't exist, but something that exists is not findable under ultimate analysis. They're referring to things that, if it existed inherently, it would have to be findable, meaning it would have to exist from its own side, ultimately, truly, inherently, and nothing exists in those ways. So the wording there is a little bit funny. So all phenomena exist conventionally, but none of them exist ultimately. Right? So Gaia makes it, I think, a little easier. Nothing exists ultimately. Why? Because all things lack essential nature. That would be findable under this ultimate analysis. All things, even emptiness, exist only conventionally.
But it is findable under ultimate analysis.
It's findable under ultimate analysis, but it's not findable as inherently existent. Right? It doesn't have any essential nature.
It's also found as a byproduct. That's not what you're looking for. If you were to analyze emptiness itself, you'd find the emptiness.
Yeah, that's true. Emptiness also is empty. And so if you were trying to analyze emptiness and see its ultimate nature, you would find the absence of an inherently existent emptiness. So he gives some examples that make, I think, this easier. And it kind of ties into these things of how we know things exist conventionally. It has to be known to a conventional consciousness, right? It can't be contradicted by another conventional kind of knowledge, and it can't be contradicted by ultimate knowledge. So then he gives some examples. A table appears, or let's say a gong appears to our conventional mind, and it's established as a gong. And it still exists even though it's empty when you look with ultimate analysis. So we have a gong, no problem. That's we see. But how about the reflection being a face? When you look in a mirror, you see a face. That reflection being a face appears to our conventional mind, but it's contradicted by conventional knowledge. All of us in the room who are a certain level of intellect know that when we look at a reflection in a mirror, it's not a real face, it's just a reflection of a face. So that's contradicted by the second one. But how about the person that appears to a conventional mind? That one isn't contradicted by conventional knowledge. We see people all over the place. Nobody says you're not a person. That one is contradicted by ultimate knowledge. There's no inherently existent person there. So when we go back to this question, does emptiness exist inherently, then we come to verse 98. The reality is later asserted, I think these verses are kind of hard. The reality is later asserted suchness of what was formerly imputed by ignorance. When a thing is not found, how can there be a non-thing? So what they're trying to do here is keep us to be going to nihilism, to this extreme. So the ignorant mind is a distorted mind. It's blind. It's blind to the ultimate nature of things, but it's also superimposing true existence that isn't there. So then we need to, you know, study and understand that. And then we'll get to a place where it's clear to us that this true existence is imputed by ignorance and it doesn't exist at all. And then the qualm comes up. But although things don't truly exist, that non-true existence itself truly exists. This is the thing, that the qualm that comes up. Right? You following it? Although things don't truly exist, the emptiness of this gong does truly exist. That's the qualm. And Nagarjuna says, hey, when we search with analysis to see if things truly exist, we don't find any truly existent things. So how could a non-thing, the emptiness of true existence, be truly existent? That's kind of the answer. And I find that weak, personally. I had a hard time with this. But I will tell you what they said, and then we'll see if it gets any stronger. It did you a little bit, and I went back and listened to Venerable Children, but I still find it a little hard. The non-finding was never really defined, was kind of the hard part for me. The non-finding of truly existent things, I guess that's how you have to take it. That isn't truly existent because the things themselves aren't truly existent. That's the reasoning. So one way they said that helped me more was when they said, emptiness exists in relation to conditioned things. These are the bases of emptiness. If you didn't have the gong, the basis of designation, you couldn't designate the gong, you couldn't have something that was empty of inherent existence. The bases don't exist inherently, but what is based upon them, their emptiness, so then that can't exist inherently either. That's how they do the reasoning. I find it a little weak still. I don't know. I need more proof statements, so then I had to go to something else. Which is what they do in the verse is they go to the next verse, which is the permanent phenomena. So this is maybe getting closer because emptiness is a permanent phenomena. So now we're seeing that emptiness exists. It exists, in relation to permanent unconditioned phenomena. Yeah, so emptiness, not only impermanent phenomena are empty, but permanent phenomena are empty. So this is how they're going to try to help us to refute inherent existence now of unconditioned space. So now we get to the space, and that's verse 99. Since it is merely the absence of obstructing form, notice she uses the word form, that helps Venerable Children's argument tremendously here. Unconditioned space is merely a designation. How can there be form without the elements? Therefore, the mere designation also does not truly exist. That's our verse. Since it is merely the absence of obstructing form, this space, unconditioned space is merely a designation. How can there be form without the elements? Therefore, the mere designation also does not truly exist. So we first have to explore unconditioned space. Okay. We have to see if unconditioned space inherently exists. So for me, I had to go and understand this unconditioned space a little bit better. So I'm just going to give you what I got. Good luck. This works for me. I hope it will work for you. Okay. So space is a non-affirming negation, this kind of space. So what are these affirming and non-affirming negations? That's the first question. So let's give examples first. An affirming negation is implying something. You're negating something, you're getting rid of something, but you're also implying something. So, like, for instance, the fat Devadatta is not eating during the day implies that he eats at night, right? That's an affirming. He's not eating during the day, that's what you're negating, but he's fat. So you're implying that he eats at night, right? You're negating that he eats in the day, the fat Devadatta doesn't eat during the day, but he's fat, so you're implying that he eats at night. So you're implying something with that negation, right? That's an affirming negation. But how about non-affirming negations? Okay, so the first example is easy to understand, but it's actually using a non-existent. So the horns of a rabbit. The horns of a rabbit are non-existent, right? But anyway, but you can talk about horns of a rabbit, and they actually don't inherently exist. They're non-inherently existent. But that doesn't imply that they have another kind of existence. You're negating the horns of a rabbit being inherently existent, but you're not implying anything else. You're not implying another kind of existence. This is from Jeffrey. This is from Meditation on Emptiness, page 214. This is an example. I think it's kind of easier to understand because horns of rabbits, but it is got a twist in it because it's a non-affirming negation, right? The horns of a rabbit are not inherently existent. They're not. You aren't going to find any horns of a rabbit out there that are inherently
that's fair enough.
Existent.
But just the term horns of a rabbit or horns of a rabbit are not
What's being negated? Here, you're negating.
What's the non-affirming negation?
What are you negating? I can answer it that way better. You're negating that they're inherently existent, but you're not implying any other kind of existence. We're talking about something that happens to be non-existent. But we can talk about horns of a rabbit. And you can say, you can negate their inherent existence. They aren't inherently existent.
I don't understand what negating its inherent existence has to do with it being not a non-affirming negation.
You're not affirming anything. You're not affirming any kind of existence.
Well, whether it's inherent existent or not, just saying horns of a rabbit because it's a non-existent, is that what's being implied?
No, the negation, what you're negating in this example, the statement is this. It is said that the horns of a rabbit do not inherently exist. They are not inherently existent. They are non-inherently existent. So they're saying it in three ways. They're basically saying the horns of a rabbit are non-inherently existent.
Okay, so the whole phrase is a non-affirming negation, not just horns of a rabbit.
Well, when I ask, you could say that. I don't know how to answer that. What I can say is, what are you negating? Here you're negating that they're not inherently existent. The fact that horns of a rabbit are not inherently existent doesn't imply that they have another type of existence. You're not implying that they have any other kind of existence. So let's go on to the next example. I find this easy enough. We have heard about the diamond slivers. Because what we're talking about here is getting rid of the conception of inherent existence, right? So this is a good choice. The diamond slivers, that's these reasonings that have this thesis, the subjects, things, are not inherently produced. That's the thesis. Why? It has four reasons. Because they're not produced from themselves, they're not naturally existent others, they're not from both, they're not produced causelessly. So this is the diamond slivers. All of those four reasons, each of those theses are each non-affirming negations. Each one. Mm-hmm. This is on page 133. So they don't imply anything. The point here, what we're trying to say, we're trying to do is give examples of non-affirming negations. So you seem to have a point. Do you want to bring it up? All we're trying to do here is say that they don't, what a non-affirming negation is. These are examples. They're not implying anything else. When you say that things are not inherently produced because they're not produced from themselves, from naturally existent others, from both or causelessly, all of those are non-affirming negations. They're not implying anything in their place. Like, what could they apply? They could apply the existence of no production from self. But they can imply a non-affirming negation. I'm just trying to talk about what are affirming negations and what are non-affirming negations. How do they work? A non-affirming negation negates something, but it doesn't imply anything in its place that is a positive. But it can imply another non-affirming negation of the same type. This is how we prove lack of inherent existence. So let's...
What we're saying is the example is the whole statement. Things are not inherently produced because they are not produced from themselves.
That's one.
Things are not inherently exist because they're not inherently because they are not produced from other.
Right.
So that whole
That's
statement,
another one.
Each of those
there
individually
four,
is
each individually are non-affirming negations.
Negation.
Each thesis. Yes.
And so the proof of each of these four is irrelevant in this conversation.
Yeah, we're just trying to explore what is a non-affirming negation and how do they work?
Okay.
What do they negate and what do they allow? They actually allow another non-affirming negation that are of a similar type, of the same type.
Yeah.
And if you didn't have that, I mean, you have to have that. So what that reasoning does is each of those is disproving that they're... Things are not inherently produced, right? Things are not inherently produced. But that doesn't establish that they're produced conventionally, nominally. It doesn't establish that. But it does establish that it can help to establish the absence of inherent existent production. That's that. It's not implying that nominal production, right? Because that would be like a positive a non-affirming negation can only imply a non-affirming negation of the same type. So let's go on, and I think that maybe it will become more clear. If it was if this was an affirming negation, the diamond slivers, it would contradict Nagarjuna, the intention of Nagarjuna, which is to eliminate all elaborations of true existence. And the only way you can eliminate all elaborations of true existence is with a non-affirming negation. It's the only thing that's appropriate. So then they bring in the space, and this makes it, I think, easier. So what is space? Well, one definition is it's a mere absence of obstructive contact. It's all-pervading. So we have to understand a little bit more what is this space, to use the example. And the space is not that easy to understand. We've had some arguments about this here, and I answered one of them by reading this. So space, this kind of space is all-pervading. There's an absence of obstructive contact everywhere, even where this gong is. For without an absence of obstructive contact, this obstructive object couldn't be there. So it's everywhere, okay? And it's because it's a mere absence of obstructive contact, it's not affirming anything positive in its place. It's in this sense that emptiness is said to be similar to space. It's not affirming anything positive in its place. And it has parts. And the way they explain it is different than I've heard it before. This is from Meditation on Emptiness. He says, each physical object, and this is the way Venable explained it too. Well, I'll do both and we'll see if we can understand it. This is where I had trouble, you know. Each physical object has a lack of obstructive contact. That's confusing to me right there. Each physical object, what are they talking about there? She says this, Meditation on Emptiness says this. Also, space, like emptiness, has parts because each physical object has a lack of obstructive contact, just as each object has its lack of inherent existence. That I find confusing, but as you go on, it makes more sense. The space of an object refers not to the area of the object. The space of an object refers not to the area of an object, but to its absence of obstructive contact associated with the object. So that's how you bring the object and its space together. And that's important, because that's how Venable explained this too. So I'm going to stick with this one first, and then we'll just keep going and see if you can understand it. So then we go on. The Prasangikas say that the presence or absence of another obstructive object is what allows or does not allow an object to be moved. It's not the space itself, which is just the non-affirming negation of obstructive contact. So what does that mean? The presence or absence of another object is what allows or does not allow an object to be moved. Well, that makes sense. The lack of unconditioned space is everywhere. It's everywhere. It's that those things are running into each other that doesn't allow this to move any farther. That's what that's saying. It's not the space itself, which is just a non-affirming negation, not implying anything, right? Positive. So still, and this is... well, I don't know if we should throw that wrench in. So we'll leave that one out. We'll leave that one out. That's Jeffrey going off on a tangent. Still, space, it's not said that space is what allows for the movement. Just as emptiness doesn't cause Buddhahood, space doesn't cause movement. Mm-hmm. That's the thing here. Okay, so then maybe we'll go to Venable's next. I don't know which is worse. Which is harder. Hers was interesting, because she translated this differently. And then she went back and she said, unconditioned space you can talk about as the absence of tangibility, the absence of obstructability, or the absence of form, which is different to me to say the absence of form. But anyway, then she explained it that way, and it was a little easier. Form isn't truly existent. So how can the emptiness that depends on it be truly existent? It can't. Why? Space is posited in dependence upon obstructing form. Because the obstructing form doesn't inherently exist, the unconditioned, unobstructive space, which depends on it, can't inherently exist. It's an interesting way, but she's kind of explaining what the verse says. I think hers is a little easier. So why isn't form inherently existent? Because it depends on parts. The elements. And these elements also depend on, they're mutually dependent on their subparts, right? So space is designated in dependence on the absence of form. I don't know about that. It's that, well, that's because that's how she defined it, the absence of obstructive contact. But she also uses form, absence of form. And that's kind of nice when you get to the way she could then tie form and prove inherent existence, the lack of inherent existence. You see how she did that there?
She says, and since form is empty of inherent existence, so is space, how could, which is designated dependence on the absence
right.
of form.
Yeah, it's easier when you use form to make that work. So here's what the verse said from our text. It says, unconditioned space is merely designated on the absence of obstructing form. Space is merely a designation. As such, it doesn't inherently exist. I still have a hard time connecting the dots. Space is a non-affirming negation. It's the mere negation of obstructing form. Because obstructing form, which is what's being negated, it doesn't exist inherently, it's a mere name. Space, too, must be a mere designation. Since space is posited in relation to form, it also lacks inherent existence, and space must also lack inherent existence. Okay, that's as best as I can do it. Now I go back to something that makes more sense to me to end. So, yeah, pretty good for time. For me, I go back to, I repeated this already, what works better for me is what was taught when they taught the middle wheel of the Dharma. All phenomena don't exist in and of themselves. They exist dependent on other factors. Impermanent things depend on causes and conditions, parts being merely labeled. Permanent phenomena depend on parts and being merely labeled by term and concept. Because they're depending on something, they can't be independent. If they're not independent, you know, something that's inherently existent has to be independent, not related to other factors. That's a little easier for me to follow the logic. But to go from this one thing, like here's where the problem is. Well, I don't know. Yeah, it's a little hard for me to make all the leaps there, I guess. Because the space itself is, I don't know, it's hard, don't you think? Space is posited in dependence upon obstructing form. Because the obstructing form doesn't inherently exist, the unconditioned space, which depends on it. Well, because it depends on it. There we go. That word depends upon it. Yeah, that's right. It depends on it. Okay, let's do that again. Yeah, you can't have unobstructed space without something to obstruct it, I guess.
Yeah, and form would be the only thing because consciousness isn't
right. So that's why she uses form. But you know, so I always heard it initially as lack of obstructive contact, also.
But what's going to contact it?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so it is. Yeah, that we answered it. Finally, we got there. Okay. Did everybody get it? How could you have a lack of obstructive contact unless there was something to obstruct it? It depends on there being something to obstruct it for it to be unobstructed. You know what I mean? Kind of. They are depending on each other. They're in relationship to each other. Kind of like short and long. You can't have short without long. There's no short to this. This is really not short inherently, right? I mean, this is pretty long if you're an ant. You've got to walk. How many times your body length? Probably a few hundred. So that's long for an ant, short for an elephant. They just step on it. Their foot's bigger than this. So there's no inherent, there's no inherently existent long or short. So that's how they relate, mutual dependence. We got that one. Whew, saved at the bell in the last minute. I think we better stop.
Thank you.
That was confusing. Yeah, now let's bring up the qualms, because it's not that late.
Can you do 20 quickly, and then we can start with the new quiz next time?
If you can, yeah, please.
Well,
I'll read the question, but I can't answer it. I didn't even look at it. What's the point? I don't even have it in front of me. What's the question?
How do you hire
a Who's teaching next time?
I'm not teaching. I'm just leading the review.
Yeah. Do you want to do this next time? It's the beginning of the next chapter, which I imagine all the rest of the questions come from. Or do you want to just...
Well, you seem to have a bee in your bonnet to go at it.
Let's read this.
I'm not looking ahead.
Well, let's at least read the question.
Yeah.
What's the question? I don't have it.
How do higher rebirth and the highest good relate to each other?
Okay. How do higher rebirth and the highest good relate to each other? Higher rebirth, we know what that is. And highest good, which is nirvana, essentially liberation. How do they relate to each other?
Can't have one without the other.
True. You need a whole bunch of the first one to get the second one.
This actually has quite a long answer.
Okay.
So why don't we do that?
We'll do that next
time.
That's yours. Okay. So now what I didn't want to forget is to dedicate. And it's Thanksgiving. And at the Sakya Monastery, we always dedicate for all the turkeys. And I learned recently that the presidents of the United States free 2 turkeys or something?
Tater and Tot.
Tater and Tot get freed or something. Those 2 lucky turkeys.
Two out of
who knows how many.
Millions.
That's a lot of sentient beings that we, I'm not joking now.
No.
So let's kind of sit for a moment and digest, and then let's turn our attention to dedicating, and let's think about all these beings and all the other beings that are in need. Especially people who don't have a spiritual path and have human minds. So let's sit quietly for a moment. And remember your qualms that came up that we want to talk about at the lunch off the line. We want to pursue these points. This is important to not let these points go. So I'll read this for our dedication verse tonight, and then we'll do our regular one. There is no meditation, nor any meditator, no deity, nor any mantra. Here there is nothing at all to be removed, nor anything to be established. Look perfectly at perfection itself. Seeing perfection, you will be free. Since whatever arises is the natural condition, if you pay attention and leave what appears alone, it will appear as pure emptiness. Without question, this is the king of yogas. Dear to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. Peerless Supreme Spiritual Leader, Omniscient King of the Shakyas, Motherly Tara, Supreme Bestower of Longevity and Wisdom, Vast Ocean Assembly of Sources of Refuge, grant propitious here and now for a nectar of benefit and bliss to flow. With a clear mind of extensive learning gained from following the wondrous traditions of Tupten, the Able One's teachings, you bring clarity to masses of disciples with the light of children, the lamp of the Dharma. May your lotus feet remain unfaltering for a very long time. Through your dharmic deeds of hearing, thinking, meditating, and so on, place those who seek the liberated path in harmony through immaculate discipline. Please lead all beings to liberation with undeclining excellent qualities of scripture and insight, and establish them in a glory of eternal bliss. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the
Shravasti Abhi in the world.